Third Court of Appeals. Sorry about the wait, but I've learned that it was much easier when I was sitting over here or over here because I could get all my papers out and while everybody else is talking, and I've just learned to make y'all wait because otherwise I can't keep my thoughts organized. So thanks for your patience. Welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. We only have one case set for oral argument this afternoon. I think possibly even we're the only one for the day. As you know, each side gets 20 minutes to argue. We're going to reserve 5 minutes for the appellant's rebuttal unless we've been told otherwise, and you've told the clerk that. Is that right?
That's
yeah.
Right.
Lighting system. See, it's got red, green, and yellow. When the yellow light comes on, that means you have 2 minutes left. And for you, regardless of which side you're on or which portion you're on, when you get to that two-minute point, you might want to think about wrapping up that thought. When you see the red light come on, that means that you are out of time. So please finish that thought. Feel free to do that. And if you want to continue, please ask for leave of court. Today's proceedings are audio recorded. We're not like the Supreme Court. We don't have cameras or anything like that in here, but the audio recordings will be available on the court's website within the next day or two. My understanding is it's pretty quick. The microphones here are for purposes of the audio recording. They are not for amplification, so if you can't hear in the back row, we're sorry, you'll just have to move up. If anyone has cell phones, other devices that could make noise or otherwise interrupt the arguments of the attorneys, please go ahead and turn them off or turn those devices on silent mode. We need to hear what y'all have to say. And I think with that, we are ready to go. I'm going to go ahead and call first for announcements, and then we'll proceed. So this is cause number 0319303CV. Lantana Ridge Property Owners Association versus SJWTX Inc., DBA Canyon Lake Water Service Corporation. And for the appellant?
Your Honor, Beth Richards for the appellant.
And you're ready to proceed?
I'm ready to proceed.
Okay. And for the appellee?
Peter Kilpatrick for the appellee.
All right, thank you. And whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your
Honor. May it please the court. The central issue, the central question here really is whether or not the appellee's easement was burdened by a prior right at the time that it was granted. And that the briefs have obviously gone back and forth about what that means. And our position is that the prior right is the right of annexation that was created in the year 2000 by Lantana Development when it owned a large parcel of land, 626 acres, that it was subdividing into, to start with unit one of this Lantana Ridge property subdivision, and imposing a regime of declarations of covenants, conditions, and restrictions on that 357 acres. But at the same time, Lantana Ridge created a right of annexation that governed not only the balance of the 626 acres, but also potentially land outside of that tract, given the right circumstances. And it's undisputed in this case, and it was found by the trial court, and I don't think there's any dispute today, that the easement was granted on the land that was owned by dirt dealers, that was conveyed by Lantana Development, that was a part of that remainder of the 626 acres, originally burdened with the right of annexation.
But when it was conveyed to dirt dealers, it was, the declarations were there for the entirety of the subdivision, but that land had not been annexed yet.
The declarations at that, well, yeah, there had been units 1 through 7 created at that mm-hmm. point, we think, and we assume that those subdivisions had all been annexed.
Mm-hmm.
The covenants, conditions and restrictions that applied to the subdivision had not been applied yet to the balance of the 626 acres, including the land
Unit
that was
eight.
Bought by dirt dealers.
Okay.
But the right of annexation, they were burdened by that right of annexation, which was created in 2000, as I said. And that's really the key right here. If if there's no, the right of annexation is basically, we talk about bundles of sticks here today, right, in the briefs. One of the bundles, of one of the sticks from that bundle that Lantana Development kept for the declarant was the right to impose these restrictions on certain land. And so when it conveyed land to dirt dealers, it kept that back. It said, we're conveying this land to you, but we're keeping the right for the declarant to impose these restrictions on you at sometime in the future. And that was mentioned in the deed that was given to dirt dealers in the subject to clause that we've talked about a little bit. It was also mentioned in the title policy. The title policy accepted the right of annexation from its coverage. In other words, it said, hey, if your land gets annexed, we're not going to cover that as a defect in your title. The right of annexation, I think, was mentioned also in the water service agreement that was granted to SJWTX, and it also was mentioned again in the easement that was granted to SJWTX. So everybody knew that this right of annexation burdened this land, and it could happen. It was like the sword of Damocles hanging over this land. At some point, it could fall, and when it did, the restrictions would come into force. And that's what happened in 2013. In 2013, dirt dealers, acting as the declarant, annexed this land into the subdivision, which, if you look at the papers here, dirt dealers bought this 86 acres from Lantana Development and almost immediately began arranging to bring it into the development. They hired a water services company. They had a contract with them. They created a plat that wasn't filed immediately, but they had a plat that they showed everybody and said, here's what we're going to do, and it showed it as Lantana Development Unit 8. So there's no doubt that the intention was to make this a part of the subdivision ultimately. Which they did in 2013. So we understand that SJWTX is contesting the fact that the restrictions went into place after it received its easement. And we don't dispute that, obviously. Mm-hmm. We can't dispute that. Our point is that its easement, their right to the easement was prior to that instance happening, but their right to the easement was not prior to the right of annexation. And if you split those two apart, then the right of annexation, you're taking away that property right from the declarant to impose these restrictions. So it's not a free pass to just go with SJWTX, and therefore you're preserving property rights. You're ignoring a property right that was retained by the original developer if you do that.
What about the property rights for the easement?
The easement had the property rights that an easement would have, subject to, and it's in the deed records, the right of annexation. Because the right of annexation was prior to their right, they took their easement subject to that right. Just like anybody else, if you buy a piece of property and there's some prior burden on it, you take the property subject to that prior burden. So you don't always get all of the sticks. And an easement holder gets probably the least of all. You have an easement holder, you have a leaseholder who has more, you have a license holder who has somewhere in between those two. And then you have a fee simple who has the most sticks, although even they might not have all of them. In this case, that's what happened to dirt dealers. They had a lot of the sticks, but they didn't have this one stick that would prevent them from having these restrictions imposed on their land. We talked about the annexation process. It's in 2.01 of declarations, and it's a long paragraph. Judge Kirkendall had, mm-hmm. he struggled with how do we interpret this paragraph. And I've set out how I think it plays out. There's basically three divisions in it. The first division, it applies to this entire 626-acre tract that Lantana Development held when it created the declarations. And it says that the declarant can, by filing a right of annexation, impose the restrictions on any of the land in that 626 acres. And there's no other conditions on it, other than a time limit. There was a time limit. They couldn't do it after December 31st, 2030. But at the election of Lantana Development, it could impose the restrictions just by following this notice of annexation on any of this land within the 626 acres. The second clause is where things get a little difficult, because it says that if the other property that you're talking about imposing these on is contiguous to the development, that it takes the declarant and the owners of that property agreeing together to add the land. So the question is, what land is that? Is it the land that's inside the 626-acre original intention, or is it land that's outside? And you apply the rules of contract interpretation here. We want to give both clauses meaning. We don't want to negate any of the rights given in either clause. And if you merge those together, it creates some interpretation problems. One of which is you had a right where the declarant had his sole right to impose restrictions, and now you're saying, but only if he gets the agreement of the owners, if there are other owners.
Well, and that brings me to a question.
Yes.
If it's muddy, how is this unambiguous so as to survive either of y'all's motions for summary judgment?
Well, I think when you apply the rules of contract interpretation, you can unmuddy it. You know, so the rules are you interpret it so as to give each clause meaning. You interpret it so that they don't contradict each other, and you consider all the words of the provision. And one of the words it's a small word but has a lot of meaning is or, which is between these two clauses. By putting or in there, the author of the document was saying, here's an alternative. This is not the same as the thing that went before it. It's something else. So that creates a division between the two clauses. And so then you ask, well, how can we make these work together? If the second clause governs property that's inside the 626 acres, then you have a conflict because you have property that one clause says the declarant can impose the restrictions unilaterally, and another clause saying he has to have the consent of whoever owns that property. So now there's a conflict. So the way to resolve that conflict is to read it so that the second clause applies to property that's outside the 626 acres. So if the development has grown at some point in the future up to the edge of the 626 acres, and there's a developer who has the land beyond that line and says, I want to be part of Lantana development, he can talk to the declarant. And if the declarant consents, then the owner of that property can also consent, and they can bring it in to Lantana development and become part of that development as well. And that way, both clauses retain their full meaning in the full intent. Both parties have the same authority that they had originally, and they're able to exercise their rights the same, equally.
What about the properties defined in this document too? So in the second clause there, it says such additional property is contiguous to the real property subject to this declaration. Does the fact that property was defined before have any effect on that second clause there?
Well, the word property in the declarations, it is defined as a capitalized term for property, and it's talking, it's referring to the original 357 acres of Unit 1. So when the declaration is talking about property capitalized P, it's talking about Unit 1, and I think probably arguably other units that follow Unit 1 that have become part of the development. But certainly it applies to Unit 1. 2.01 is talking about additional real property, and it's lowercase p. It's talking about something that's not the property. So that's the distinction there. So 2.01 doesn't apply, obviously, to the original 357 acres, which is big P property. It only applies to additional property somewhere else. And it could be inside the 626, the remainder of the 626 acres, or it could be property that's outside the 626 acres, or even in the third clause, which you talked about, I talked about in the brief, it could be something not even attached to this development. And of course, in that situation, they allow the development to decide if they want to encompass this property
not, right,
that's remote to them, which makes sense. So it works together logically that way. You give all the clauses meaning, and it allows it to be to operate fully and completely.
So I have a procedural question.
Sure.
So these are competing motions for summary judgment. Traditionally, once we get there, we take a look at both motions. We take a look at what the trial court, the relief that it granted, and then we render whatever judgment the trial court should have. Agreed? That's our usual standard for
sure.
Review.
Yes.
In your motion for summary judgment, you suggest, you discuss your claim for the breach of the covenants. I didn't see any basis for us to do anything about the declaratory relief that was alleged in your petition. Is what you're asking for, was that a final, would it have been a final summary judgment if we would have been proceeding on just y'all's motion for summary judgment?
I think that If at the end of all this, there's a judgment granting summary judgment for Lantana Ridge, it's not final. It's not final for two reasons. First, because Lantana Ridge would be entitled to attorney's fees under the 37.001, the attorney's fees statute for contracts. And it also, there was a pleading in the petition for an administrative penalty of $200 per day.
For the TAC violation.
For the violation. And so I think those.
And those aren't contested in this appeal, correct?
They're not contested?
Hmm?
I'm sorry?
Did I understand that the finding on the nuisance per se and the on the denial of the take nothing motion for summary judgment for the TAC claims, I did not understand that those are in this appeal. Am I mistaken? That they were not separately challenged?
That's true. That's true.
Okay.
That's fair enough, yeah.
So what's the effect of that? I mean, is the motion for summary judgment that was filed by y'all, is it seeking final judgment? Or is there something that is still out there and pending?
Well, it reserved the attorney's fees issue. I mean, that issue was not presented to the trial court, and the trial court didn't decide it because we didn't get to that point. We didn't find a violation of the contract. So if this court were to grant a judgment saying, interpreting the contract and saying that SJWTX was in violation, it would have to be remanded to determine attorney's fees to be paid to Lantana Ridge.
Is there something other than attorney's fees that is there for the remand? Specifically the injunctive relief. I didn't see anything in there about the injunctive relief in the motion for summary judgment.
Yeah, and I think the intention at the time was that if the summary judgment was granted, the injunctive relief would be considered afterwards. And I would assume it would be kind of a pro forma. The trial court entered into an order scheduling all this out, and it originally scheduled the hearing on the summary judgment motion. And then immediately following that, if it was granted, there was going to be a hearing on the injunctive relief request.
So how is the declaratory judgment different than the basis for the breach of the covenant?
The declaratory judgment.
Mm-hmm.
We're not asking this court to make a declaratory judgment. We're asking this court to find there was a breach of contract by SJWTX when they failed to. Yeah, I'm out of time.
So. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and I don't want to eat up his time, the 5 minutes, because I'm going to go a little bit off. But under the usual, in the appellate process, if there's competing motions for summary judgment, the trial court grants for one and denies for the other and renders a judgment. On review, the appellate court looks at both motions and essentially renders the judgment that the trial court should have rendered. That's the usual course. That's usually how things transpire.
Right.
There's a case out there that is called CU Lloyds of Texas versus Feldman. Are you familiar with that case at all?
Not.
It was a shock to me to find. It basically holds that before a court of appeals may reverse for summary judgment or for one party and render a judgment for another party or do something along those lines, both parties must have ordinarily been seeking a final judgment in their cross motions for summary judgment. I don't see that y'all were seeking a final judgment in your cross motion for summary judgment.
Well, I mean, I agree.
I'm sorry. Yours was the original, but right. I don't see that y'all were seeking a final judgment in that motion for summary judgment.
I agree. I think SJWTX was seeking a final judgment, but Lantana Ridge was not. Lantana Ridge was seeking a judgment that the contract had been violated, mm-hmm. and then the relief it was requesting would have followed from that. But the only reason it was final was because the relief was granted to SJWTX, and that became a final judgment when they got their attorney's fees awarded.
Okay.
I guess to further on your point, neither party asked for a final summary judgment at that hearing. It was partial. Because the final judgment didn't occur until there was a trial on attorney's fees.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court.
Were you asking for a final summary judgment?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. In fact, when we went to the summary judgment hearing, Judge Kirkendall said, we're going to take up a, we'll take up the issue of an injunction and attorney's fees at a later time. We're not going to do it today. And so at that summary judgment hearing on the cross motions, we were seeking a motion for summary judgment on all matters. And as I recall, they were too. When the court granted our motion for summary judgment, there was nothing left to try except for attorney's fees. And that was clear, because if the CCRs are not encumbering the property right that our client acquired, then there was no basis for an injunction hearing. If you'll recall, they took that up on an interlocutory appeal before we could even get to attorney's fees, and this court agreed that that was premature because of the pendency of the attorney's fees issue. And so that's why it was remanded back. We had that hearing on attorney's fees. That was the only remaining issue, because all other issues had been resolved other than attorney's fees. And Judge, you're right, they did not carry forward, and I believe Mr. Pritchard confirmed that. It was hard to hear just a little bit, even though I was just 3 feet away. I think I heard him say that there certainly is no appellate points being brought up on the issue of that, of the TAC finding against them and the
nuisance per se.
And for that matter, the nuisance, common law nuisance. The only thing that I see that they brought forward is this issue of declaratory relief, which was a part of their amended and final pleadings when we went to trial, when we went to the summary judgment hearing, and as to whether or not the
CCRs, just because it was a part of their pleading doesn't mean it was part of the relief that they were seeking in the original motion for summary judgment, though, was it?
My recollection,
because I mean, we have partial summary judgments all the time.
Right.
It's all right.
I believe, you know, as he said, the key issue was, I think both sides were moving for summary judgment on the issue of whether the CCRs are applicable to our property interest, and
thinking that is the dispositive issue.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Had the summary judgment been, if my summary judgment had been denied and their summary judgment had been granted, then there would have been an evaluation, obviously, as to whether injunctive relief would have been necessary. Of course, at that juncture, we would not have. I don't even think that would have been necessary, because if they had won a summary judgment that it was encumbered, then we would have had to, under those circumstances, not have any basis to contest an injunction that we stopped building the water plant site. So.
Well, and so then, and I hate to, you know, if you want to say some things in the interim, but eventually go ahead and get to whether or not there's some ambiguity with that's contained within 2.01.
No, ma'am. And no one asserted ambiguity. I know that's not binding on this court, mm-hmm. but no one asserted ambiguity. No one indicated that we needed a jury trial. No one indicated that. In fact, Mr. Brewer, who was trial counsel, and I just agreed, you know, one of us needs an attitude adjustment. Let's both move for summary judgment. Mm-hmm. That's what mm-hmm. we did. Mm-hmm. And no one has mentioned ambiguity. In fact, today is the first time I've heard even the suggestion of it, to my recollection.
Okay, so Exhibit A, not the Exhibit A for the property, but from the trial court's order on the competing motions for summary judgment. Unit A was conveyed to Dirt Dealers, Mr. Kane's company, subject to the right to annex Unit 8 to the CCRs in Section 2.01. In a confusing paragraph, the CCRs do not make clear in the parties' dispute whether or not annexation of the property in Exhibit A could be done without any consent of property owners. It's undisputed that Exhibit A contains what became Unit 8, but upon a close reading by this court, it is my opinion that the interpretation lies between a distinct. But that paragraph necessarily suggests, well, it says what it says.
Of course, Your Honor, but the judge would not have granted a motion. I don't believe the judge would have granted a motion for summary judgment if his finding was it was ambiguous, and therefore there should be fact issues that remain for interpretation or of that matter. But the judge does say in a confusing paragraph or whatever, mm-hmm. as you decided. And this is not, so mm-hmm. may I proceed?
Yes.
So the way I understand this, Judge, of course, I know my minutes are precious. I don't want to pretend like standing is not an issue, that this that could be dispositive of this issue, but for the purposes of answering and just getting right to the lick log, is even if we assume that the court of this, that this POA had standing, Judge, their entire case is based on this notion. Mr. Pritchard said our position is that the right to annex in 2000 was the prior superior right. That the right to annex is something that encumbered my client's property when it bought property later. That was the superior right. That potentiality of it being annexed was like some kind of present servitude. And there's just nothing in the law, Judge, that supports that notion. If you look at the actual language of the CCRs in that declaration, the declarants, successor, or assignee, as of this other real property, we're not talking about Unit 1. My client took an easement in what became Unit 8, completely different property. By the way, I don't even see anything clear in that. I don't see anything that they've shown or demonstrated that Unit 8 is even in that 600 acres identified in Exhibit A.
I thought that that was uncontested, that Unit 8 was at least in the 620 some odd acres.
They've said that. I don't see that in Exhibit A. I mean, you can read Exhibit A. They said that if you triangulate the surveys or something, that you can make that determination. I please invite you to read Exhibit A. I can't make that determination. Clearly, the property that was 86 acres that dirt dealers acquired was nearby. You know, I don't dispute that. But so even that would be a basis which, if by summary judgment proof, if they fell short, would be dispositive. But for the purposes of assuming that they have standing, assuming that the 86 acres was a part of that unit, of that mm-hmm. Exhibit A, then if I could speak to that, Judge, mm-hmm. then under those circumstances, if you actually look at the declaration, it says declarant, successor, or assignee has the right and option to extend the CCRs to such other real property that might be in that Exhibit A or that might be contiguous. And then it says, quote, if and when, at a later point, a successor or a assignee or the declarant wishes to bring in that property, if and when it wishes to exercise an option to assert a right, then at that juncture, as to that real property, assuming for the moment that's in Exhibit A and part of the 600 acres, then there's two things that has to occur before the CCR can extend to that, in this case, 86 acres, which became 48 acres.
Was this suggested in the original motion for summary judgment? Is this all part of what the trial court originally considered?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Kilpatrick, how do you distinguish El Dorado Land, which is a case that the appellants have cited, from what you're arguing? So are you familiar with that case?
Not off the top of my head, no, ma'am.
It's a issue in the case whether a reversionary interest consisting of a grantor's right to purchase real property on the occurrence of a future event was a sufficient property interest to support an inverse condemnation claim. And the basis of this option was a property right, the Supreme Court in 2013.
Judge, I apologize. I'm not familiar with that case, but I can mention this, if I may, and I'm not trying to dodge the question. I just confess I'm not familiar with that. But, Judge, getting back to the potentiality, I mean, how remote this potential right was. This potential right was a right, not an obligation for a successor or an assignee of Lantana Development to exercise, and if it was going to be exercised, they had the option to do it if and when it wished to bring it into the CCRs, and even then it wasn't applicable unless two things occurred. Number one, there had to be consent by the owner of the property that was going to be encumbered by the CCNRs. Consent. And the second thing that had to be required is this filing of a notice of addition to land. And then even after
didn't that occur, though?
Yes, ma'am. After my client obtained the easement right. So after my client obtained the easement right, and which was irrevocable, perpetual, a blanket easement, it was a
solid property right recognized in Texas. When my client obtained that right in June of 2012, it was well after that, a year and a half after that. I apologize, 8 months after that, when the notice of addition to land was filed, and then it became, then the rest of the rights in 48 acres became subject to the CC&Rs. So, but my client's property right, and the easement rights it acquired in June of 2012 was when it was not even platted. And my client got a warranty of title from the developer that it was free and clear of any encumbrances because it was unplatted. And so after that, a couple of months after that, it was when dirt dealers, as to the remaining interest, platted that property, recorded it, and of course in that recording it mentions the water site easement at least twice in terms of the recording information. So that recording information was available to the public in June of 2012 when my client received that easement. And so that is the superior interest, because my client's easement property rights was acquired when it was unplatted. And of course that's how developers do things. A developer, in this case it was dirt dealers, a developer is going to say, well, before I plat and encumber this with restrictions, I'd have to talk about, you know, residential usage, and that any improvement has to have, you know, a three-car garage or two-car garage or how.
What about the special warranty deed? Isn't that how dirt dealers, the 2008?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, what about that? What about the language in that?
What about the what in that?
The language in the 2008 special warranty.
I'd be glad to talk about that, Judge. In that warranty deed, which is from the Lantana to my client, first of all, it's a little bit confusing, some of the language, because in addition to that 86 acres, mm-hmm. Dirt dealers also bought a platted lot from a different unit, Unit 5. So there is, the CCRs was applicable to Lot 32, Unit 5, because that was a part of the conveyance. But the real issue is that additionally, separately, but in the same conveyancing instrument, was this 86 acres. And none of that 86 acres, of course, Judge, was a part of Unit 1. No one is disputing that. So we're talking about new acreage. And so Lantana, if the Lantana Development Company had wanted to have made that property subject to the CCRs, it had 8 years and every opportunity to do so. All it had to do was, well, I'm the owner, I'm going to consent to now encumbering this 86 acres before I sell it. I'm going to file a notice of addition to land so that that it's platted, and then I'm going to file this notice of addition to land before I sell it to dirt dealers.
But then what do we do with the subject to clause?
The subject to clause, Judge, if you look at the Teal case that I've cited, for example, mm-hmm. all the subject to clauses indicates the right. And there's no doubt dirt dealers later had the right of annexation if and when it ever wished to exercise that right. When dirt dealers, that's all that means, and in fact the Teal case talks about subject to language meaning only just words of notice, not burdening. Subject to does not create affirmative rights. It is just notice of warning, notice of just words of notice is how Teal describes it, which is how it should be applied here, because nowhere does the deed say that the property was encumbered. Nowhere was there a notice of addition to land that was signed by the gentleman for Lantana Development. So when dirt dealers acquired it, Judge, in February 2008, it was a blank canvas. You know, this 86 acres, not platted, not subject to a notice. He had the right of annexation. I understand that they're saying that somehow the declarant, Lantana, could still reach out and touch and affect even after his sale. I doubt that, but it doesn't matter because there's no evidence that he's ever done that. Whoever Lantana Development is never filed a notice of intention. Whoever Lantana's development is never sought to affect the rights after the sale of this 86 acres in February 2008. And by the way, that title policy that he mentioned, that title policy says that CC&Rs are not applicable to this 86 acres. It is applicable to that Lot 32, Unit 5, which I wish I'd never been involved in that because it's just a red herring, has nothing to do with any of the issues here. But the title policy, very conservative institutes, found that, excuse me, the title company accepted that from the title policy. It found that that lot in Unit 5, of course, is followed, is subject to it, but not the CC&Rs because they could see that there was no notice of addition to land that had been filed.
Are you saying that dirt dealers couldn't be considered the declarant?
That's a good question. Ultimately, it did act like the declarant on the day that it filed its notice of addition of land. Before that, it never identified itself as a declarant. That's confusing to me. One reason is because these CCRs themselves talk about how the declarant has the right to appoint ARC members and that its powers will be delegated to the ACC when it sells, I don't know, I think it's half the lots or some percentage of the lots. So the CCRs themselves indicate that, you know, as an assignee, it's the ARC or the ACC. But clearly, Dale Kane's company, Dirt Dealers, was at least a transferee, a successor of 86 acres that was owned by Lantana. And so based on that, on February 2013, Dirt Dealers files its notice of addition. And in that language, you'll see that they use the word declarant. But clearly they were the developer. And that developer
can we reach the issue of whether or not Dirt Dealers was the declarant? Because it wasn't raised in your motion for summary judgment.
Not necessary.
It's not necessary. Okay.
Oh, ma'am? Because, I mean, what we know is this. My client received a perpetual, irrevocable easement in June of 2012 before, when it was unplatted, before.
And that subject to has no relevance here whatsoever.
The subject to, in terms of the conveyance in which Lantana acquired that property back in 2008, just merely meant that people need to be on right, that whoever has this 86 acres has a right, option, to bring that CCRs within it. And if you actually read it goes on to say in the original declaration, the CC&Rs, it says, after that notice of addition of the filing of the land, when that's recorded, it, quote, then and thereafter applies. So the notice of addition of land filed in February 2013, then and thereafter apply, if you look at that language. So you got words like option, you got words like if and when, and then you got words like then and thereafter if they ever decide to do it, which meant, of course, that the CCRs were applicable as to the rest of the property interest that Dirt Dealers had. It certainly didn't apply to those interests that it had already transferred to my clients a year and a half earlier. But as to the rest of the interest that Dirt Dealers had in February 2013, Dirt Dealers consented to it, filed that notice of addition to the land, and it then and thereafter became applicable. And I want to point out, Judge, that if you actually look at the definitions, what it became then and thereafter applicable to, if you actually look at the definitions, even as of February 2013, it becomes applicable only as to lots, platted lots, the fee interests in platted lots. If you read the definition of lot and owner and property, that's the only conclusion you could come to. So even if it didn't even say that and it said all property, it still wouldn't have reached back and affected our clients who had received that easement a year and a half prior. My client received that in June of 2012, that easement. You know, I said a year and a half, didn't I? I meant that 8 months. I apologize, 8 months later, not a year and a half. In other words, the notice of addition to land was done 8 months after my client received the easement. But when my client received the easement, it was even before it was platted. When my client received the easement, it was like a couple of months later in August of 2012, when Dirt Dealers, as to the remaining interest in that 48 acres, went ahead and platted it. What I'd like to point out to the court, Your Honor, is back to that conveyance. When Dirt Dealers received that 86 acres, it was that blank canvas I was telling you about. There was no obligation for Dirt Dealers to have developed anything on it. It could have ran horses on it. It never had to develop anything on it. It could have had a working ranch. But he also could have decided, you know what, I don't like those CCRs. I want to call it Happy Acres or Green Acres. And I want to come up with my own peculiar CCNRs that allow for, you know, condos or garden homes or something different. He had all those rights. Ultimately, he decided that it probably made the most marketing sense to go ahead and call itself Unit 8. And later, after getting the easement infrastructure in, the water, electrical, and other easements that come in, that ordinarily come in when the land is unplatted, that after that he was going to, and he ultimately did, subject what was his new residential development that he called Unit 8, and at that point, it there and thereafter became applicable, I think, just to the residential lots in which the fee interest owners, because that makes the most sense, right? Those are the people that will be building homes. But it's certainly not applicable retroactively to a water company that needs to put up a, by the way, this is not one of those elevated towers like you see when you go into a small town. This is 24 by 24 foot tank. And so Judge, respectfully, the judge received the judgment, got it right. We'd ask that the court affirm the judgment, the summary judgments as granted to my client, is denied by and is denied to the POA. Are there any other questions, or should I sit down?
Thank you.
Take that as an option. Sit down. Thank y'all.
Your Honor, just to kind of go back on to a couple of things that counsel mentioned. He talks about the warranty deed that Dirt Dealers received and from Lantana Development, saying that it said he got this land, Dirt Dealers got the land free and clear of any encumbrances. First of all, if the warranty deed said that, which I don't think it does, that doesn't mean that Dirt Dealers could convey land free of the encumbrance that is the right of annexation, because the Texas Property Code 5.003 says, excuse me, that a title holder can't pass more title than he owns. So if Dirt Dealers had a title of this land that was encumbered by a right of annexation, it could not convey a lot, it could not convey the land and remove that right of annexation burden on the property. So I don't think it's correct to say it was free and clear of encumbrances. I think, in addition, the deed itself, I don't think it's that confusing. As counsel says, there is a subject to clause. It does say in part, it's on page 622 of the clerk's record in paragraph 1, that the CCRs weren't in effect yet at the time this deed was granted. It does say that as to tract 2, or it says they are as to tract 2, which is that's the lot he was talking about. It also says in the next paragraph that the land conveyed generally in this warranty deed was subject to the right of annexation. That's in paragraph 2 on page 622 of the warranty deed. And then also as to the title insurance, counsel said the title insurance affirmed that his property wasn't subject to a right of annexation, and that's exactly the opposite of what it says. On page 293 of the clerk's record, which is the second page of the title policy, Exhibit A, I think, there's a continuation of a list of objections that or of encumbrances that the title policy will not cover. And in paragraph D of that is the right of annexation to the terms, conditions, provisions, easements, restrictions, reservations, and other matters, and it identifies the document number of the declarations of covenants, conditions, and restrictions. So the title policy recognized that this deed conveyed land that was encumbered by the right of annexation, not the opposite of that.
What do you say to the
yes
the position about the Exhibit A not including the 86 acres?
I'm sorry?
The Exhibit A to the CCRs about it not including the property that's at dispute here, that it's ambiguous or...
Oh, then Exhibit A to the CCRs, which is the 626 acres, correct? And you're asking, was the 86 acres encompassed in that? But the trial court found that at least implicitly in his order by saying that they were subject to the CCRs because of the right of annexation. So it couldn't have happened without that. It also, and the other issue on this is like I think the court pointed out, this wasn't a contested issue. Everyone agreed, and I think it's in the transcript, the trial transcript, where the court asked the parties if they disagree that this was within the 2,626 acres, and everybody, I believe, agrees. I could provide the cite to that to the court after the oral argument if you'd like me to, or I'll try to. that's my recollection. And that's the answer to that question. It wasn't something that came up before. No one thought to prove it with all the I's and T's dotted because we all agreed that was true. Maybe we still don't agree that. I don't know. But that's the basis on which this judgment was granted. So I think that's kind of where we are, law of the case type of situation. I wanted to push back a little bit on some of the language. The easement was not a blanket easement. I mean, easements are perpetual. Easements run with the land. That's all true. This was not a blanket easement. This was an easement to construct a water plant. That's the only purpose that could be used for. They couldn't go there and, create a rodeo arena or something. So it wasn't a blanket easement. It was a restricted easement. Easements under the law are interpreted narrowly in order to not deprive the property owner of his rights. The easement doesn't become a separate parcel. This easement is on lots 21 and 33, I think, of Unit 8. And those lots still exist. They're still platted just the same way. The owners of those lots still own that land. It just has an easement on it. So, the argument that it somehow doesn't apply to the easement because it's not a lot, well, that's not correct. The easement is on a lot. It's a property interest that's on that lot, and the construction on that lot has to comply with the CCRs when they're in place. So we would ask the court to reverse the trial court and render judgment and reverse and remand on the attorney's fees issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you have any other questions?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And with that, the case will be submitted.